Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell. I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, metaphysics, business, things that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. Today, I'll review the highlights of two books. The first is The Four Agreements, A Practical Guide to Personal Freedom by Don Miguel Ruiz, published in 1997. The second is The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown, published in 2010. So who is Don Miguel Ruiz? He was born in rural Mexico, where his mother was a healer and his grandfather was a shaman. The family anticipated that Don Miguel would embrace their centuries-old legacy of healing and teaching the Toltec knowledge, but he really wasn't interested initially. It took a near-death experience to change his life. Stunned by the experience, he devoted his life to the mastery of the ancient ancestral wisdom. In this tradition, a Nagual, or master teacher, guides an individual to personal freedom, and that is Don Miguel's gift to the world. Thousands of years ago, the Toltec were a society of scientists and artists in southern Mexico. They explored and conserved the spiritual knowledge and practices of their ancient teachers. Over the millennia, the Naguals kept the ancestral wisdom concealed and didn't share it when conquerors like the Spanish came. The Naguals felt the Spanish were not prepared to use it, or might misuse it for personal gain. After his near-death experience, Don Miguel felt that it was now time to return this knowledge to the people. Toltec knowledge is centered around the same essential unity of truth as in all sacred esoteric traditions. It's not a religion, and is most accurately described as a way of life, a life filled with happiness and love. As humans, we use language to understand and communicate with each other, and every word in a language has an agreement to it on what that word means. The meaning is transmitted from one person to another down through the ages. And as a society, when we agree on what a word means, we believe it. And that's called faith, the faith to believe unconditionally. It's the agreements we make as a society about the words in our language mean so that we can communicate with each other clearly. Don Miguel writes that all of these agreements are kept in our subconscious mind, the place where all that we've done and experienced is stored. He calls it the Book of Law. For instance, if I asked you the name of your second grade teacher, it may be on the tip of your tongue for a minute, but the information's there. Oh yes, it was Mrs. Cartwright. Whatever's in our own Book of Law is our truth. We also have an inner judge that uses what's in our Book of Law to judge everything we do. Have you noticed how fast we are at judging things? We judge everything. Oh, yes, Mrs. Cartwright. Well, she was this and this and this. Then there's another part of us that receives the judgment. He calls this our victim part. When we do something that's against what is in our Book of Law, the victim part of our consciousness accepts the blame, the guilt, and the shame. It says, yeah, I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough, intelligent enough, and on and on and on. And then the judge turns around and says, yeah, you're right. When we go against our Book of Law, our body responds. It feels funny and it brings up fear because what we had in the Book of Law has to be true. So anything that challenges what we believe will make us feel unsafe. Here's a personal example. My father died when I was 10 years old and my brother was 8. Our father was ex-military and he adored my brother. So when my father died, my mother was very sad that my brother didn't have dad to mentor him. She would overly gift him with whatever he wanted as he grew up. You know, I had to go to Catholic school the whole time, and he got to go to the public school. It was outrageous. But I started believing that I was not good enough and not favored, and I carried a sense of resentment in the corner of my mind for many years. You know, it's hard to admit that, but it's true. I never mentioned it to anybody. 60 years later, when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, she gathered all of the pictures of us and made two albums, one for me and one for my brother. She split the pictures as evenly as possible. And when I looked through both albums, I was stunned. Because in almost every picture of my brother, there was I. And every picture of me, there he was. It's crazy how all that time I felt I wasn't good enough for our family. Post note, my brother and I are very close and we talk every week. He's one of my best confidants. Don Miguel calls this type of mistaken belief emotional poison. Wow. When we feel there may be some injustice in our life and we remember it again and again and again, he writes that 95% of the beliefs we've stored in our subconscious mind are nothing but lies, and we suffer because we believe these lies. Oh, that hurts. Today, if we don't like what the dream of our life looks like, we need to change these agreements. When we're ready to change, there are four very powerful agreements that will help us break the previous agreements that kept us with less energy and less love for life. If we adopt these four new agreements, they'll create enough personal power to change the entire system of our old agreements. So the drama of hell will disappear right before our eyes as we begin creating a new dream, a personal dream of heaven. The first agreement is to be impeccable with your word. It's the most important one, because with just this one, we can transcend to a level of existence that Don Miguel calls heaven on earth. Through our word, we express our creative power. Our word and our intent manifests in change. Our word is a force, the power we have to express and communicate with each other. The truth is, our word can create the most beautiful dream, or it can destroy everything around us. He calls the misuse of our word black magic, since through our negative judgments, we thoughtlessly put spells on each other. Another misuse of our word is gossip, and that makes others feel as bad about something as we do. The second agreement is don't take anything personally. When someone says something negative about you or your work, and you take it personally, it's because you agree with whatever they said. But as soon as you agree, the poison runs through your system and you're trapped in the dream of hell. It's selfishness to assume everything someone says about us. Nothing other people do is because of us. It's because of them. When we take something personally, we make the assumption that they know what's right in our world. It's like eating their emotional garbage. Blah! Don't take it personally. If someone is treating us with love and respect, it's a gift if they walk away. The third agreement is don't make assumptions. We have a tendency to make assumptions about everything. The problem is we believe our assumptions are true. So too often when we make an assumption, we misunderstand, we've taken it personally, and we end up creating a big drama for nothing. It's always better to ask questions than to make an assumption, because assumptions set us up for suffering. They set us up for suffering. Making assumptions in relationships is asking for problems. For example, we make the assumption that our partner knows what we think and that we don't have to say what we want. We assume they're going to do what we want because they know us so well. And when they don't, we feel hurt because they should have known. When we're young, we may assume that everyone sees life the way we do. This is the biggest assumption that humans make, because when we realize that's not true, we can have fear of being ourselves around others because we don't want to be rejected or to be around people who want us to change. Don Miguel writes that if we try to change people, it means we don't really like them. When we stop making assumptions, our word becomes impeccable. That's pretty clear. The third agreement reinforces the first. The fourth agreement is always do your best. It's an action step that supports the first three agreements. Although our best may change moment to moment, that's okay. Just keep doing our best. No more, no less. If we try too hard, we'll spend more money and energy than needed. That's funny, I said money. That's true. When we do overreach, we deplete our body and go against ourselves, and it'll take longer to reach our goal. If we always do our best, there's no way we can judge ourselves. It's the action in itself that will make us happy. There's a story about a man who wanted to be enlightened, to transcend suffering. So he went to find a Buddhist master. And he asked the master, "If I meditate 4 hours a day, how long will it take me to be enlightened?" And the master replied, "About 10 years. The man then said, "Well, what if I meditate 8 hours a day?" And the master said, "Definitely 20 years. The man said, "Why will it take longer if I meditate more?" And the master said, "You are not here to sacrifice your joy in life. You're here to live, to be happy, and to love. If you can do the best in 2 hours of meditation, and instead you spend 8 hours, you're only going to grow tired, you're going to miss the point, and you won't enjoy life. So do your best, and perhaps you'll learn that no matter how long you meditate, you can still live, love, and be happy." The Four Agreements are a summary of the Toltec's mastery of transformation. If you're impeccable with your word, if you don't take anything personally, if you don't make assumptions, and if you always do your best, then you will have a beautiful life. In 2010, Don Miguel and his son Don Jose wrote a book called The Fifth Agreement, which is about seeing your whole reality with the eyes of truth. It's complete acceptance of yourself just the way you are, and the complete acceptance of everyone else just the way they are. And the result is you'll have a love affair with life. I'm sure you're going to want to read that. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805. Or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through a website called careasy.org. And if you have any questions, heck, give us a call, 1-855-500-7433. The author of the second book, The Gifts of Imperfection, is Brené Brown. She's a research professor at the University of Houston's Graduate College of Social Work. She specializes in studying shame, authenticity, and belonging. Tough subjects. Her groundbreaking work has been featured on PBS, NPR, and CNN, and she's done 2 TED Talks. She takes the reader on a journey from "What will people think of me?" to the conclusion, "I am enough." In her research, she's found her specialty with the ability to see trends and patterns and assign meaning to it. She's written over 15 books, and the other one that I have that I really like is Daring Greatly, on how the courage to be vulnerable transforms the way we live, love, and lead. Brené has collected thousands of stories from diverse people all over the country, from ages 18 to 87. She found that stories about people living and loving with their whole hearts meant so much to her that she felt the words "wholehearted living" described it all, and yet she still wanted to know more. What made people value their lives? How did they create resilience? How did they resolve their concerns? What were the positive patterns, and what gets in the way of wholehearted living? She made a list of recurring themes and saw a pattern of what we call do's and don'ts. In the do column were words like rest, I like that one, play, that's a good one, trust, faith, intuition, authenticity, love, joy, gratitude, and creativity. In the don't column were words like perfection, numbing, certainty, exhaustion, being cool, fitting in, judgment. It was the toughest lesson she learned from this research because she started underlining items on the total list that she could see in herself. Yeah, they were mostly in the don't column, like perfection, exhaustion, and the need to be cool. She felt embarrassed, so she put the list and her reams of research papers in a box and put it under her bed and didn't look at it again for 2 years. In the meantime, she got a really good therapist and did some serious soul work, and that changed her life forever. You know, at first, she thought she had a mental breakdown, but eventually, she began to realize it was a spiritual awakening. Brené found how important it is to know and understand ourselves, but there's something even more essential to living a wholehearted life, and that is, get ready, loving ourselves. It became clear to her that we can't give to others what we don't have. It's important to love ourselves. As she was going through this period of unraveling, trying desperately to find out what was the life she wanted to live versus the life she assumed she was supposed to live. Anybody like that? How was she going to let go of who she thought she was supposed to be and embrace who she truly was? You know, it's a compelling story, and I hope you find time to read it. Wholehearted living is about engaging in life from a place of worthiness. It's cultivating the courage, the compassion, and connection to wake up in the morning and think, no matter what gets done or left undone today, I'm doing the best I could, and I know I'm enough. And at the end of the day, knowing the truth that, regardless of what we've achieved, we are worthy of love and belonging. The first thing Brené did to shift her consciousness of not being enough was to embrace what she calls the dig deep button. It's for those times when we're pushing ourselves to meet a deadline or an expectation. When we're exhausted and overwhelmed with too much to do and too little time. Ever been there? She learned the dig deep button from interviewing people who found their way into wholehearted living. When they were almost at that place of wholehearted living, that's when they would dig. D, deliberately reset or shift our thoughts through meditation or clarifying our intention. This can be done while taking a walk, listening to music, enjoying a summer breeze, or just sitting on the front porch and observing life. I, inspire. Let those actions inspire us to make new and different choices, even if the choice is to take a nap, stop work earlier than usual, buy some flowers, or my favorite, eat some ice cream. G, going for it. Take action by practicing courage, compassion, and connection with others in your life. Let's take a moment to look at those three words, courage, compassion, and connection. You know, there's ordinary courage that shows up in those moments when we put our vulnerability on the line. It might be when a friend asks for help and we don't know how to help. It's when we ask for what we need, like a hug or a favor, and we don't get it. It's like being late for an appointment with a good friend and being honest why we're late. I just forgot. Been there. Compassion is learning to relax and gently move towards that which scares us. The Latin root words for compassion are to suffer with. The barriers to practicing compassion are the fear of setting boundaries and holding people accountable. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Brené writes that before her awakening, she was sweet, sweet, sweet on the outside, but judgmental, resentful, and angry on the inside. She found out that compassionate people set boundaries in their relationships and hold people accountable for their behavior. So those negative reactions have no room or reason to show up. It's interesting how boundaries and compassion fits together. She found that those people who truly practice compassion were the most boundary-conscious people in her studies. Compassionate people are boundary people. And why is that? The heart of compassion is really acceptance. You know, it's hard to feel compassion for people who are taking advantage of you. For instance, someone who promised to mow your lawn yesterday and didn't show up, or maybe have an employee that misses another deadline on a project that was due and the customer is unhappy. Instead of just waiting to see how things work out, any type of agreement or expectation should begin with setting a boundary or a deadline, and then hold people accountable with consequences. And, you know, it is a lot more work than shaming and blaming them, but it's also a lot more effective. If we don't follow through with appropriate consequences, people do learn to dismiss our requests. The key is not to is to separate the person from their behavior and address what they are not doing, but not who they are. Today, we seem to be living more of a blame culture. We want to know, whose fault is it? How are they going to pay? There's a lot of screaming and finger-pointing, boy, a lot this past month, but rarely do we see people being held accountable. It's just easier to be heavy on self-righteous anger and low on compassion. The third word is connection, and it's an important result in the dig process. Connection is a positive energy that's created between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, and when they can give and receive their opinions without judgment, and when they derive sustenance and strength from the relationship. You know, as human beings, we are wired for connection. We need connection to thrive emotionally, physically, spiritually, and intellectually, and that's based on hard science. You know, today with all our digital tools, it's so easy to be confused about our connections. Just because we receive an email or somebody posts something on our Facebook, it doesn't mean we're heard, understood, or cared about. What we've learned so far is that in this journey of wholehearted living, it's a path of consciousness and choice. It's the willingness to tell our stories, feel the pain of others, and stay genuinely connected. And it cannot be done in a half-hearted way. We have to be all in. So what gets in the way of wholehearted living? It's shame, fear, vulnerability. Shame is the fear of being unlovable, the total opposite of owning our story and feeling worthy. Brené defines it as that painful feeling of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Go back to the first book. Okay. It keeps worthiness away by convincing us that sharing our stories will lead to people thinking less of us. It's all about fear. Fear that people won't like us if they really know the truth about us. Yet to feel shame is to be human. So there's three things that support us in feeling shame: secrecy, silence, and judgment. And yet what we find is that shame loses all of its powers once the words are actually spoken. Here's a personal example. Years ago, I moved to Reading and found my spiritual home. I was very quiet about myself, but I freely asked questions of others just to get to know them. People appreciated my interest in them, but I was very cautious about sharing anything about me, because as a buyer in the pulp and paper and wood products industries, I learned that sharing information about myself could be leveraged against me in my never-ending negotiations with suppliers. One day at church, the pastor took me aside and shared that he was concerned because he could see that I was cheating. Me? An amazingly successful businesswoman? As honest as the day is long? And he gently said, "Yes, Mary, you're cheating people out of getting to know you." You could have knocked me over with a feather because I knew he was right. And he said, "This church only becomes a community when we truly get to know one another and experience that deep caring and connection." That following Sunday, as I sat at a table with others in the social hall, I went ahead. I just blurted out something I had done during the week, and people just looked at me and said, "That's nice." I remember it like it's today. My unrecognized fear of being instantly judged left me, and I began sharing with anyone who would listen, and it actually became fun. And, you know, that's the next chapter in this book, Cultivating Authenticity. It was a great lesson for me. So skipping ahead, in Chapter 7 on Cultivating Play and Rest, Brené shares the research of Dr. Stuart Brown, a psychiatrist and clinical researcher and founder of the National Institute for Play. Doesn't that sound like fun? And his book, Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. He describes the properties of play. First, play is apparently purposeless. And the opposite of play is depression. We're biologically programmed to need play because it can bring back excitement and newness to our day. Pray helps us deal with difficulties. It provides a sense of expansiveness. It promotes mastery of our craft, and it's an essential part of the creative process. And true play comes from our inner need and desire to find lasting joy and satisfaction. In the long run, he writes, work does not work without play. The last chapter in Brené's book is Cultivating Laughter, Song, and Dance. As she sifted through all her data, she asked herself two questions. Why are laughter, song, and dance so important to us? Is there some transformational element they have in common? And here's what she learned. Laughter, song, and dance create emotional and spiritual connections. They remind us of the only one thing that truly matters when we're searching for comfort, celebration, inspiration, or healing, and that is, we are not alone. Laughter is a form of communing without words. When we're laughing with each other, we're saying, hey, I'm with you. I get it. Songs and music stir memories and provoke emotions like nothing else. It reaches out and offers us a connection. For me, there's nothing like the music of the 50s or 60s that make me want to dance. Dancing is a form of self-expression that is literally full-body vulnerability. Whether or not we're graceful or can move to the beat, it's always joyful. So it's true. A good belly laugh, singing at the top of our lungs, and dancing like no one's looking are unquestionably good for the soul. In her final thoughts, Brené writes that meaningful change is a process. It can be uncomfortable and often risky, especially when we're talking about embracing our imperfections, cultivating authenticity, and looking the world in the eye and saying, I am enough. But if we're afraid of change, the question we must answer, what's a greater risk? Letting go of what people think or letting go of how I feel, what I believe, and who I truly am. Brené believes that choosing authenticity and worthiness is an absolute act of resistance. Yeah, resistance. Choosing to live in love with our whole hearts is an act of defiance against society's norm, I guess. We might confuse and terrify a lot of people with what we share, maybe even ourselves. And then we'll wonder how we can feel so brave and so afraid at the same time. She says it this way. Here's how I feel most of the time. Brave, afraid, and very, very alive. You know, I hope you've enjoyed hearing about who we are as perfectly imperfect individuals and how we can all choose to have a love affair with life. Choose this for good in your life and the lives of everyone you love. And for those you don't love, use it for their good anyway. It's another small step in bringing peace to the world. You know, the music for this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds, and it's called Symphony for the Senses. And it even comes with a full color booklet on their many adventures. So until next week, may peace be with you. Love it.